Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Do you know a student getting ready to go to college? Or are you looking at going back to school yourself? The Woodward Hines Education Foundation and the Get to College program help more Mississippians get to and through college to get certificates and degrees that lead to meaningful employment. They offer free college planning advice, including hands-on FAFSA completion assistance through in-person or virtual appointments. Visit gettocollege.org to learn more.
Good morning. It's 8:30 on Friday, April 12th. I'm Desiree Frazier. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. On today's show, the Mississippi House is reviving their education funding bill despite Senate efforts to block it. From the Gulf States newsroom, Jackson has struggled to keep drinking water safe and affordable. Now the city's taking a new approach through one of the nation's oldest safety nets. Plus, billions of taxpayer dollars are being used to fund plastics manufacturers that pollute. That's according to a new report from the Environmental Integrity Project. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. The Mississippi House has revised its Inspire Act. I keep saying revised, it's revived, just days after the Senate moved to gut the bill and insert their own plan. Senate lawmakers want to modify the Mississippi Adequate Education Program, the formula used to currently fund education. But the House is seeking to write a new formula that could fund schools at a higher margin. The debate is now taking place through rewrites of Senate Bill 2693, as the Senate chose earlier this week to not meet with the House and find a compromise. Our Will Stribling speaks with Republican Representative Jansen Owen of Poplarville. He's the co-author of the Inspire Act. He says the House plans to send their plan back to the Senate in hopes it will then be invited to conference.
When we heard about the Senate's failure to invite conference on our Inspire Act, that was a failure to continue in discussions. So they decided, the chairman or whomever decided, that neither piece of legislation was worth a conference committee vote, was worth us coming together as the two chambers of this legislature and discussing our ideas and trying to come to a compromise as far as public education is concerned. So they ended discussion at that point when they killed the bill. And as I've said before, and as Speaker White has said, Inspire is the House's number one priority. We intend to see this done this year. So whenever we saw that happen, we decided, we'd give the Senate another shot. So we found a bill and we passed an amendment and we sent back to the Senate. And I think it's important to note that while the Democratic leader in the House came out and said he was opposed to it, or his caucus was opposed to it, 2/3 of House Democrats voted for Inspire. We increased in our vote gain to 105 people voting for this bill. That's Republicans and Democrats. A sheer majority of House Democrats voted for it because they see, like we see, that this bill is focused on funding students and funding schools that need this money more than ever before.
I was going to go to the Democratic Caucus statement because it pushes on this narrative that something nefarious is going on here and that this is in some way a backdoor to voucher legislation or some other effort to take money from private schools. The voucher bill that the House killed could, if y'all had passed, could have been enacted under MAEP or Inspire, as long as a Bates student cost is included, it slots in neatly. So we talked a bit about the accuracy of those sorts of allegations or innuendos.
You know, that's totally false, and it's asinine, really, that the leader or anyone would continue to say that there are some nefarious issues with this bill. I mean, man, this bill has been out there for almost 3 months now. The Democratic leader knows how to read. He can read the bill and he can do the math himself. There is nothing in that bill that has to do with vouchers. There's nothing in there that makes it easier for vouchers. The only thing it might do for vouchers is in a world where there is vouchers, you know, the special needs kids on the voucher program might get a little bit more money because we're putting more money on the state plan into the special needs kids. But the idea that you could say, oh, we need to shortchange public education because one day we might give too much money to the voucher kids, that's totally ridiculous. It is a ridiculous argument. And it's honestly disingenuous to an extent. The fact of the matter is there is a public education advocacy group right now who has been dedicated to MAEP for the past 20 years. The Democratic leader and others are basically pushing that group's talking points, and that's all it's about. It's kind of shameful that we are having a fight this hard to send this money to these schools, particularly when the leader of the Democratic Party in the House claims to be somebody who supports doing that. That he would stick with a program that shortchanges those schools for in lieu of a program that is actually on paper sending money to the schools that need it if he would just do the math. That's all it takes.
Y'all is sending Inspire back over to the Senate. Do you think that sends just a clear message that y'all aren't going to tolerate there being no debate on this issue? And has there been any response on the Senate side to that action yet?
I hope that it sent a message that this is our number one priority and we want to continue to talk, that we're not just going to stop because the Senate says they don't want to talk anymore. Now, there has not been a reaction on that particular bill, but earlier today, the chairman brought up the appropriations budget that we passed a few years ago that funded Inspire. Of course, he took our funding out and put in the funding from the Senate plan on MAEP. But one important thing he did say on the floor when asked a question about would he guarantee that we could have an education budget this year, he said he was committed to an education budget even if he had to level fund it. So he would rather level fund this year's education budget than work on a compromise to put up to $300 million more dollars in education. Not even going to talk about it. So that's where we have a key difference between the House and the Senate as to what we want to do. And I hope as the session progresses, we can come together and invite conference on our legislation and continue to talk about this.
And then one final question. Would you just address the other criticism that this process has just been too rushed and then we need more time and to hold public hearings and the such if we're going to make this big a change to how public education is funded?
It's actually not too rushed. Like I said, the bill's been on the books for 3 months now, and unlike MAEP, it's very easy to apprehend and understand. It's very easy to understand what this bill is going to do. Unlike MAEP, which everybody should know the details of because it's been around for 20 plus years, the Inspire Act is easy. We do this all the time. We put legislation all the time. We present an idea. We intend to talk about it. This is a $300 million investment in education. It's money we have now. Next year might be different priorities, different situations. Why miss out on the opportunity without even engaging in further discussion?
That's Republican Representative Jansen Owen of Poplarville. He's co-author of the House's Inspire Act. Senate lawmakers don't want to change the funding formula this year. Yesterday, the chamber passed an education appropriations bill to fund K-12 schools at the same rates as last year if there are no additional changes made to education funding formulas before the end of the session. Republican Senate Education Chair Dennis DeBar of Leakesville says this will allow schools to get funding regardless of stalled debates on formulas.
I've committed that if we publicly and privately, that if we cannot agree on a new Inspire or come to a compromise with the House on the education funding formula, that I've committed to the new state superintendent and everybody else that at the very least, we can level fund education so that our districts will have a budget. Because as you know right now, districts, if they have not already hired their teachers, they will have hired them by April 15th. And by end of May, they're going to enter into contracts with their non-certified personnel. And so if we leave without a budget, as I was informed today, you're looking at RIFs or cutting back services. And if you have RIFs where teachers don't have contracts in my area, they could be going to Alabama. along the lines. People going to Memphis or Louisiana because they want some security. These teachers do. So, and I don't blame them. And so I think it's imperative that, you know, we have a budget when we leave here, and I'm committed to making that happen.
Both the House and Senate education funding plans would increase education funding by several hundred million dollars. Coming up from the Gulf States newsroom, Jackson Water is trying to find new ways to help people struggling to afford their water bills. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio.
Mississippi Public Broadcasting's Family Fun Day will be in the Pole Gymnasium on the campus of Mississippi University for Women in Columbus on Saturday, April 20th from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. MPB has partnered with the Mississippi School for Mathematics and Science, MUW, and the Preservation Society of Columbus to host the free event. Come and meet MPB's own Ed Said. The whole family can enjoy music, a health fair, games and activities related to science, technology, engineering, arts, and math. Register at education.mpbonline.org.
An evening of jazz can be just what the doctor ordered. Join me, Meredith Michelle, with WJSU's Evening Jazz, 7 to 10 weeknights on MPB Music Radio.
Is Friday your favorite day of the work week? We're pretty proud of our Friday MPB local shows. Felder Russian's Gestalt Gardener at 9 a.m. is about your garden and life. At 10 a.m., Next Stop Mississippi lets you know the hot events going on around the state. Southern Remedy for Women is for women and the people who love them. Coming up next after Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio.
This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. I'm Desiree Frazier. Jackson is a warning for the future of America's drinking water. The city went about 6 weeks without safe tap water in 2022, caused in large part by historic underfunding. Now Jackson is trying to go from a warning to a model by piggybacking on one of the nation's oldest safety nets. Stephen Basaha of the Gulf States Newsroom reports on Jackson's efforts to solve one of the water industry's biggest challenges.
Look, there's a seemingly simple economic solution here. If your service, in this case water, costs more to run than you're bringing in, just charge more for it. And hey, compared to other utilities like power, water is actually not that expensive.
Most people with reasonable middle-class incomes don't pay attention to their water bill. They put it in auto pay.
That's Ted Hennepin, the man appointed by a federal judge to run and fix Jackson's broken water system. But one of the many problems Hennepin has to deal with is that lots of people in Jackson don't have a reasonable middle-class income. About a quarter of the city lives below the poverty line. So another idea, just charge people based on how much money they make. Unfortunately, there's no easy way for Hennepin to know that.
It'd be great if there was a national income database, and then you could take that data, draw a line, and say, these people qualify and these people don't. But none of that exists.
A lot of utilities get around this by having people prove their income to get a discount. The problem with that is most people who should be getting that discount don't sign up for it. That's because proving your income can take a lot of work.
Most of these people are working hourly jobs. You got to take time off. You're losing income. You already don't trust government. Now you're going to tell them more. So I think it's just set to fail.
So Hennepin was left looking around to see if anyone in the water world had a solution to this not-so-simple problem. That's when he came across Manny Teodoro. He's a professor of public affairs at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Fundamentally, the problem is that water and sewer utilities were not designed as social service organizations.
And he's not saying they should be. After all, that'd be a whole new bureaucracy to run. Instead, he's got a different idea. Give the discount to people already being helped by actual social service programs. They've already done the hard part of deciding who should get the aid, so just copy their notes.
Just leverage the best program we've got, which is SNAP.
SNAP. Basically, food stamps. About 80% of people eligible for SNAP actually get it. Most water discount programs don't come anywhere close to that. And this is the approach Jackson Water is taking. The utility raised water rates this year, but it's planning to automatically give a discount of about $30 to anyone who receives SNAP. Think of it as a package deal. You get your SNAP and a bonus water discount. For the most part, water experts I spoke to like this idea.
From an economics perspective, I actually like this a lot.
Ahmed Rashid Okatabi researches water policy at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
I'd love to see the results of some sort of analysis that comes out of this, but I mean, I can definitely see this taking off.
But the half dozen Jackson residents I spoke to, like Jeremy Brown and Catherine Lacey, do not like this plan.
To me, everybody should pay equal water bills, you know. It's no exception for nobody, you know.
There's elderly people that's on a fixed income, and they don't get SNAP.
Brooke Floyd is also not a fan. She's the co-director of the Jackson People's Assembly, which surveys Jackson residents about policy issues.
I know many families in this city that don't receive food assistance in any way, shape, or form and don't qualify based on the amount of money that they make, but cannot handle high bills or expensive bills.
And the thing is, the guy in charge of Jackson Water, Ted Hennepin, he agrees. SNAP is not perfect. But he believes this will still help a lot more people than what's being tried at other water providers.
My argument is really there's no better way. The best thing from our perspective, maybe the only best thing, is the SNAP benefit.
There's just one final snag in this plan. The Justice Department has refused to release the SNAP records needed to automatically give that discount, saying that would violate the privacy of people on SNAP. Hennepin is now appealing the decision to the same federal judge who appointed him to fix Jackson's water mess, something Hennepin says he needs those records to actually do. For the Gulf States Newsroom, I'm Stephen Basaha.
The Gulf States Newsroom is a partnership between Mississippi Public Broadcasting and public radio stations in Alabama and Louisiana. Next, billions of taxpayer dollars are being used to fund plastics manufacturers. That's according to a new report from the Environmental Integrity Project. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio.
Mississippi Public Broadcasting's Family Fun Day will be in the Pohl Gymnasium on the campus of Mississippi University for Women in Columbus on Saturday, April 20th from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. MPB has partnered with the Mississippi School for Mathematics and Science, MUW, and the Preservation Society of Columbus to host the free event. Come and meet MPB's own Ed Sed. The whole family can enjoy music, a health fair, games and activities related to science, technology, engineering, arts, and math. Register at education.mpbonline.org.
Our goal at Everyday Tech is to keep your technology not only working, but working for you. I'm the host, Abram Naney, and you can join me and my friends Wednesday mornings at 10 on MPB Think Radio. Or search Everyday Tech on your favorite podcasting app or download the MPB Public Media app.
Thank you for your sustaining financial support of Mississippi Public Broadcasting.
This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. I'm Desiree Frazier. Billions of taxpayer dollars in the U.S. are going to help pay for the nation's rapidly growing plastics industry. Much of that growth is concentrated in the Gulf South. But researchers say that type of manufacturing is polluting the areas they're in. Alexandra Shakovich is a research manager with the Environmental Integrity Project. She says the pollution being created by these factories is often worse near communities of color.
We looked at 50 plastics plants that were built or expanded in the U.S. since 2012, and we found that two-thirds of them received taxpayer subsidies totaling around $9 billion, but 84% of them violated their air pollution control permits in the past 3 years, and none of these plants were forced to give up any of their subsidies for breaking environmental laws.
Where are these plants? Are there any in Mississippi?
There's one that we included that's in Mississippi. It's the Pearl River plant in Hancock County, and they make polyesters and PET resins. And the bulk of these plants are located along the Gulf in the Texas and Louisiana Gulf Coast. But there are also plants in Pennsylvania, in Kentucky, and elsewhere around the country. And I should also note that, you know, we focus on just 50 plants that were built or expanded in the past decade. But that is not, those are not all of the plastics plants that exist in the U.S.
What do you want this report to do?
Well, we do make a few policy recommendations in our report. The first is that, you know, we really don't think that taxpayer subsidies should be tied to environmental, should be tied to environmental compliance, excuse me. We think that if companies can't obey the law, that they should not be rewarded with taxpayer money, and that plants that do overpollute you know, that companies should be forced to give taxpayers money back if they can't obey the law. We're also advocating for other reforms, including stricter permit limits and outright denials for single-use plastics. Again, a lot of these plants manufacture the primary feedstocks or primary ingredients used to manufacture disposable single-use plastics, and we don't think that taxpayers should be supporting pollution. We think that taxpayer money should not be going to single-use plastics production. We would also advocate for better monitoring to detect pollution around these plants and better access to public information for nearby communities. You know, one study that we cite to in our report from the EPA found that 7 of the plants included on our list released up to 14 times more benzene into communities than previously known. And benzene is a well-known carcinogen. So we know that these plants are under-reporting air pollution, and in order to address that information gap, we are advocating for more fence line monitoring and better access to information for the communities living next door to these plants who are most affected. We also need tighter pollution limits in these plants' permits, and we need to make sure that states and EPA are stepping up and holding these polluters accountable, that they're enforcing these pollution limits and imposing penalties that are proportionate to the damage that they're actually causing.
Have you been able to ascertain why they're not being held accountable?
Well, unfortunately, you know, there are penalties imposed. So one thing that we provide alongside the report is a comprehensive data set of these plants, where they're located, as well as their history, their compliance and enforcement history. And what you can see from looking at the data is that although penalties are imposed, these penalties are oftentimes their pittance compared to what these plants are awarded in a taxpayer subsidies. So, you know, again, oftentimes there are penalties involved, but these penalties are really quite low compared to the damage and the pollution that these plants are causing, as well as proportionally to the amount of money that we're giving them as in the form of subsidies.
Are you lobbying Congress over this issue?
So we are not a nonpartisan organization, and we do not lobby, but we would certainly welcome policy action in this regard.
Then who's going to handle taking this information to lawmakers who can, if they want to, do something with it?
That's a great question. I think, you know, a lot of citizens are very concerned about plastics and about the you know, tremendous environmental footprint that they carry, as well as the risk that they pose to human health and well-being, especially folks that are living in communities that are directly affected by this pollution. There are some policies in place in certain states that are currently being considered. You know, there are these polluter pay policies that impose taxes on companies that manufacture pollution. So there are, you know, there are some policies that are being considered in some places, like in New York. Unfortunately, those are not at the national level. They're really at the state level. And it's really on our local and elected politicians to step up and hold these polluters accountable and introduce policies that can address some of these issues.
Is there a growing concern about the plastic industry expanding in Mississippi?
So our plant does highlight, our report does highlight several proposed projects and 10 new plants that have been proposed. None of those are in Mississippi, but several, again, are in Louisiana and in parishes just across the border from Mississippi. And the build-out is significant. So, again, you know, 10 new plants are proposed, 23 expansions at 17 existing plants. And our report just looked at, again, these 50 plants that have been built or expanded over the past decade. So there are a lot of, you know, that's just one piece of the puzzle. There are many more plants that are operating and that are polluting across the country. And the plastics industry is, or the fossil fuel industry, I should say, is betting big on plastics. So there is a lot of build-out being proposed across the country, and we documented at least 10 projects in Louisiana alone.
All right, then. Well, thank you, Alexandra Shakovitz, co-author of a new report from the Environmental Integrity Project called Feeding the Plastics Industrial Complex. Thank you for your time and speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me today.
This has been Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio.